The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Changing the status quo is not going to be easy. Changing the constitution is also a problem. You have this time around, Sunnis and Kurds are also a bit afraid of constitutional changes. They have their own interest. Like Lebanon, there's like a vast web of interests that benefit from the status quo that are not going to give up easily. So I don't see this movement actually achieving all of it. What it has achieved already that cannot be taken from them is the massive social changes in Iraq. As someone from the country born and raised, I left around 2014, what I'm seeing today, I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. And I'm not that much older than the protesters. I never thought I'd see women staying all night aiding the injured protesters with their families. I never thought I'd see this openness about being so vocally against the status quo. I've always thought Iraqis were kind of pacified after all the violence and trauma we've seen throughout our lives. But this time it's very, very different. This is a generation that, because of the 2003 status quo or the toppling of Saddam Hussein and the regime, the Ba'athist regime, they know freedom. Unlike the generations before, they know what freedom means. They don't take it for granted, and they're not afraid.
I'm Scott R. Anderson, and this is the Lawfare podcast for November 9th, 2019. Over the past several weeks, popular protest movements have emerged in both Iraq and Lebanon, expressing widespread discontent with the status quo in both countries. The unrest has led to both the resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri and a public statement by Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdelmahdi of his intent to resign as soon as a successor is selected. But they have also been the subject of increasingly violent repression, especially in Iraq, where Iranian forces are believed to be actively combating the protesters. To discuss these developments, I sat down with Randa Slim of the Middle East Institute, Rasha Alakidi, managing editor of Urfa Sautak, and Tamara Wittes of the Brookings Institution. It's the Lawfare podcast, A New Arab Spring in Iraq and Lebanon. Randa, let me start with you. We've seen a really pretty dramatic set of developments taking place in Beirut and really across Lebanon over the last couple of weeks. Give our listeners a little bit of sense about what the major developments have been on the ground and kind of the context in which this protest movement has arisen.
So this protest movement has been now going on since October 17. We have had protest movements in the past. In 2015, we had another large movement known as the Youth Think movement over the garbage crisis that fizzled after a while. The difference about this movement, one is it's much larger than in 2015. That's one. It has involved regions. Protests are taking place in areas which have not seen protests before, specifically in Hezbollah strongholds in the south of the country and the east of the country. And in the past, whenever we had protests in Hezbollah-controlled areas, these were protests mobilized by Hezbollah for their own causes. This is the first time we see protests in Hezbollah stronghold areas by Hezbollah constituents against corruption and against partners of Hezbollah. These protests have yet to nominate Nasrallah per se as being the target of their anger, but they have been definitely protesting against partners of Hezbollah, particularly Nabih Berri, the Speaker of the Parliament, and Jubran Basil, the foreign minister and the son-in-law of the president of Lebanon, who is also a partner of Hezbollah. The other distinguishing feature of this movement is that it has been really unifying for the country. It has crossed sectarian boundaries, and it has helped create a narrative that is away from identity politics, a national narrative that is based in issue politics, you know, corruption, failure of delivering basic services, electricity, water to people, stealing public funds, lack of accountability, transparency, mismanagement of government, which has been going on for decades. But importantly, I think that maybe relates a little bit to Iraq, it's also a repudiation of the status quo, a status quo that has been in place since the end of the civil war in 1990, when a Taif agreement was negotiated among members of the political elites, many of whom are still in power right now. And so that status quo is now being rejected. And one of the principal demands of the protesters is to change these rules of the game, which were enshrined by Taif agreement. Now, whether they will succeed or not, it all depends on how long they can persist, how well they are organized, how good they can mobilize, and then how good they can strategize. Because the pushback from the elites who have been in power for a long time and who are going to be, ruthless and in deploying any tool at their disposal, except so far we have not seen major violence like we are seeing in Iraq. So deploying any tool at their disposal, co-optation, manipulation, divide and rule of the protest movement. So deploying these tools to co-opt this protest and make it fail and to protect their interests. I mean, they have strong vested interests in that they have been nurturing and protecting since 1990. The other thing about the status quo and what it means to upend the status quo is that this status quo has been very favorable to Hezbollah. I mean, after all, successive cabinets since 1992-1994 have issued these cabinet statements in which they support what Hezbollah and other Lebanese leaders call the tripartite formula, meaning it is the people, the army, and the resistance that protect the country, which means legitimizing Hezbollah's paramilitary status, Hezbollah resistance, as a co-equal, basically, component of Lebanon's strategic defense against Israel, against, any other foreign threats. And that is why, for example, we are starting to hear now from Hezbollah circles about what they want going forward. And one of the demands of the protesters, the first demand has been the calling for the resignation of the Hariri government. Okay, that's happened. Box has been checked. The second demand is the appointment of a technocratic cabinet that is composed of experts, non-partisan, non-corrupt, people who can handle especially the economy, which is in major dire straits right now. So we are now starting to hear, from around Hezbollah circles that they see the technocratic cabinet as an indirect way at basically denying the legitimacy that previous cabinet has offered to Hezbollah's paramilitary status. So a technocratic cabinet in the future might refuse to endorse the statement of the tripartite formula, which has created political legitimacy and political cover. Allah, the question is the problem with the movement. It has been organic. It has been very innovative in the non-violent tactic it has provided. It has used. It has been unifying. However, it has so far been leaderless. And we can understand why. In the past, Lebanon has a long track record of assassinating opposition people. So people who are in the protest movement, who can be leaders, might be afraid to come to the fore and say, we are the leaders, and then their life is on the line. That's the safety issue is understandable. But still, I think there need eventually in the near term for this protest movement to develop, a leadership core. And if they don't do that, it's going to be problematic, in my opinion, in the medium term. And I'm going to say why it's going to be problematic. I think it's going to be problematic. One, because there is already an argument being offered by the political elite, by the oligarchy, saying, this protest movement has no plan B. I mean, we are it for you. And that's an argument that is gaining, you know, traction among the two-thirds of the Lebanese who are not in the street, who are not protesting. They sympathize with the demands of the protesters. They suffer as the protesters have been suffering from poverty, from corruption, from, you know, political elites that have, you know, manipulated the system for so long to their own benefit. So they definitely share the same demands of the protesters. But at the same time, this is a two-thirds of the Lebanese who are afraid of vacuum, who are afraid of security, you know, of lack of security, if there is no plan B offered by the protesters. And plan B should be a leadership core of the protester. The second fear I have of the lack of leadership, you know, of the protest movement developing quickly, is that if it doesn't happen, then it creates opening for political opportunists, including among some of the political elites, to ride this wave, you know. And we have already seen attempts by some other traditional political leaders to portray themselves as being part of the protest, paying lip service, although they have been always part of this political elite that the protesters are rising against. And then a third fear, in my opinion, is that if there is no progress, there is no tangible success that the protest movement can, you know, register, especially leadership that can go and negotiate and sit at the table with the political elite and negotiate and get something, you know, in terms of tangible success. I think you can see also there is a fear that people will start falling back on their sectarian identities. I hope not, but I think time will tell whether this protest movement will be able to move from this revolutionary phase that it is in right now, and which it has been very successful at, into some kind of a governing leadership electoral phase.
And can you elaborate a little bit just in terms of the protest movement? What has been their strategy so far? I know there are some media reports today about focusing on municipal buildings and kind of major government structures, and in terms of sit-ins and obstructions, there's been efforts to shut down roadways. How is this protest manifesting? That's such a broad phrase. It doesn't necessarily communicate what exactly is happening on the ground.
I think, you know, what's happening is that, again, I'm every day I'm totally, you know, blown away by the innovation that they are deploying in the tactics they are using to keep people mobilized and to keep people, even those who are not in the street demonstrating. For example, yesterday, people there banging pans in their houses, you know, all over the country to express support for the protesters. Yesterday, there was a large women movement, a large women protest, you know, candlelight vigil, mostly led by women. Because women issues, you know, and women leaders have been at the forefront of this protest movement. And yet, I don't think there has been as much emphasis in the protesters' demands on women issues, you know, especially when it comes to civil laws, especially when it comes to women rights. And we have seen many revolutions where women always are at the forefront of the revolution. And then when it comes to government formation, when it comes to politics, you know, retail politics, then we see women not at the forefront as they were in the revolutionary phase. So I think yesterday's march and candlelight vision by women leaders, by women groups, is extremely important. And they have been participants in the protest from day one. And in fact, one of the tactics they have used, the protesters, the protest movement, is to have women basically stand at the front of every march between the men, providing like a human shield between the men and the police and the army. And that has deterred, you know, some violence from the army, but also has led to some scuffles, which led to some of the women protesters injured. But it was women themselves who wanted to, you know, who wanted to do that, partly to make sure that there will be no violence, partly to make sure that they can provide a buffer between the women, between the men protesters and between, you know, the army and the police. Other students, yesterday students, high school students went out of their schools and into the streets and in different parts of the country and protesters. You have the use of music and dancing and songs every night in many public squares. Particularly, there is one town in the north, Tripoli, which in the past used to be known as like, oh, this is the stronghold of the Salafis in Lebanon. Well, I mean, you have a DJ leading this big party every night, you know, with, of course, political slogans and sending salutations to other other cities where the protests are happening. So you have people, you have, for example, this human corridor, which was put together by the protesters, I think, last weekend, linking Tripoli to the south, i.e. linking the north of the country all the way by the seaside to the south of the country. So to show that this is one protest that is a national protest that, that you know, it all Lebanese are involved in. So they have started with roadblocks in the beginning, thinking that that's one way they can put pressure on the government, which is the case. But then eventually, I think they decided they are going to move away from that and start targeting their protests to government institutions, to against banks, against the Lebanese Central Bank of Lebanon, partly to focus on the institutions and some resorts which are owned by corrupt officials who have appropriated public lands, you know, in a very arrogant and corrupt way. So they now they are starting to target these. Again, these institutions, these properties, eventually they're going to start targeting what I'm hearing, doing sit-ins and demonstration outside the houses of leaders, you know, ministers, Speaker of the Parliament. So again, starting to target, move away from roadblocks, which I think, at some point started backfiring because, again, as I said, 2/3 of the Lebanese are trying to go to work, trying to go to school, and they are seeing these roadblocks as hampering, you know, daily life. And so I think the protesters abandoning the roadblock tactic and moving into this targeted sit-in and demonstration outside official buildings, outside banks, outside all these entities and parties and individuals who have been involved in the pilfering of public funds for decades in the past, I think is extremely smart because it focuses the public mind on who is the problem. And unlike in Egypt in the past, and I think that's one lesson learned by this protest, but also maybe our protesters in Sudan beforehand, is that you don't focus on one individual. You focus on a system that enabled that whole corruption. So in Egypt, in the Arab uprising, in 2011, they focus on Mubarak. They got rid of Mubarak. Look who they have today. They have Sisi, who is, you know, worse than Mubarak or equally worse, equally bad. But I think Sudan learned this lesson, and I think Lebanon now is learning this lesson, has learned this lesson, and instead of focusing on basically one person, they are focusing on the whole system. But that makes the pushback even harder, because now you have the whole system starting to push back against you and deploying everything they have, and they have lots of assets to be able to neutralize you and to be able to weaken this protest over the long term.
Excellent. So, you know, at the same time, we've seen this pretty dramatic series of protests developing in Lebanon. We've seen, really actually predating the protests in Lebanon, another protest movement happening in Iraq. Now, Iraq is not unfamiliar to protests. We've seen kind of increasingly severe protests happen almost every summer into the early fall the last few years, primarily centered around economic issues, often centered in the south of the country, extending other places. But this year, it became pretty evident relatively quickly that something a little different is happening, or at least layering on top of that existing protest movement. Russia, can you tell us a little bit about that?
So the first protest in Iraq, I mean, the massive protest, dates back to 2011. It was more of it was called the civic protest, the Madaniya movement. And since then, almost every year, there's been a protest, you know, against like the lack of services, electricity, unemployment. And that's been annual. This year it started around July for the same reasons, but also it included another class of the more high educated people with high degrees that did not have any employment. So they joined the unemployment class that usually included more of the poverty stricken class. And the reaction to that was violent and was aggressive, not necessarily violent. And they decided to mobilize again just to protest the aggression that happened. So this was on October 1st. It was different this year also is that there were less protests against lack of electricity and services, and mostly based on the economy and the unemployment. The number initially before noon on October 1st was around 800 protesters. That was it. And it was unable to, you know, actually gather or mobilize a larger number. It was the response to that galvanized this entire movement. The aggression, the violence, and the fact that three protesters were shot, you know, on spot that day that killed them immediately, that's what led thousands and thousands to demonstrate. And that lasted for about 12 days. The numbers exceeded 100. There were snipers that were employed. And the more violent it got, the more people were angry. It was definitely the straw that just broke the camel's back. And all of a sudden, we saw all the anger from 2003 in one massive outburst. It was definitely cross-sectarian. It definitely surpassed ethnic lines. And it was all over Iraq. And the more news broke out as how these tactics were deployed, and news initially about possibly the IRGC's influence on the decisions to, you know, quell the protests, the angrier the crowds grew. Now, there was a break for about 3 weeks. And this break is very, very important to actually observe the Shia ritual of Ashura, the Arba'in after Ashura. It just shows you who the protesters were. These were Shia protesters from the south against the status quo that had very much privileged Shia. But it's obvious now that it didn't privilege all Shia. It privileged a very specific political class and very specific economic class. When the protests resumed, there was a lot of doubt that does this movement have, you know, does it have the energy to continue? There was speculation that it's going to be just, you know, a few protesters, not so much is going to happen. But when the crowds on the 25th, when they came out in massive numbers and pretty much occupied Tahrir Square and the symbolic Turkish restaurant, which was an abandoned building where the snipers initially on October 1st stood and targeted the unarmed protesters, they occupied that building and it became very much a shrine as it is now. It was very clear that this was something new. So it didn't initially start necessarily against IRGC influence or against Iranian influence in the country, but that has now become a very, very defining characteristic, more so definitely more than we're seeing in Lebanon, where there's kind of been like cheeky references to Hezbollah and Nasrallah. In Iraq, it's very, very open. You see portraits of Khamenei and Soleimani being burnt in public in areas like Najaf and Karbala. 5 weeks ago, if someone told me that would happen, that's going to happen, I would have been like, no way, that's impossible. And the protesters are very clear that they're not against Iran as a neighbor and a country. It's just the domination and influence because of the violence that occurred. Now, had there been no negative response, no aggressive response from the government the first time, I don't think this movement would have lasted. I think the protests would have been very much like they are every year. And the government would make some, you know, promises, some empty promises, and they would just fizzle out. But this time there was a, I wouldn't say revenge aspect to it, but they want accountability. And they're not going to stop until they get that. It is a challenge, of course, now to the status quo. I do think that, again, as in the case of Lebanon, there is no leadership. The vast majority of protesters are between 15 and 25, let's say 15 to 30-year-olds. They don't have a leadership. They do demand change. They want radical change. What they know is that the system since 2003 has not served them. It's not working. They feel the country stolen. That's the slogan, Nurid Watan, basically means we want a homeland. They're saying we feel like strangers in our own country. They're saying that we have a neighbor that is more privileged than us in our own country. And, you know, the constant statements from Iranian officials are not helping, accusing them of being Saudi-backed or Israeli-backed or, you know, the same conspiracy theories that we've been hearing in the Middle East since the 50s, that is not helping. It's making the streets angrier. The prime minister, every time he speaks, people are more angry. There's a dismissal of who these protesters are, what they want, their ambitions. So changing the status quo is not going to be easy. Changing the constitution is also a problem. You have this time around, Sunnis and Kurds are also a bit afraid of constitutional changes. They have their own interest. Like Lebanon, there's like a vast web of interests that benefit from the status quo that are not going to give up easily. So I don't see this movement actually achieving all of it. What it has achieved already that cannot be taken from them is the massive social changes in Iraq. As someone from the country born and raised, I left around 2014. What I'm seeing today, I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. And I'm not that much older than the protesters. I never thought I'd see women staying all night aiding the injured protesters with their families. I never thought I'd see this openness about being so vocally against the status quo. I've always thought Iraqis were kind of pacified after all the violence and trauma we've seen throughout our lives. But this time it's very, very different. This is a generation that, because of the 2003 status quo or the toppling of Saddam Hussein and the regime, the Ba'athist regime, they know freedom. Unlike the generations before, they know what freedom means. They don't take it for granted. And they're not afraid. They have nothing also to lose. So it is that democracy, it's that the free speech that they have become very familiar with. That's what's kind of pushing them. And the social changes brought about by these protests, that I think is going to stick, and they cannot be reversed. You see the young people, the drawings and the graffiti on the streets of Baghdad, they're cleaning up. They have different markets and shop owners, you know, coming to Tahrir Square, where most of the protests are happening, and they're donating with food and with water. They've improvised cola cans and yeast to help with the tear gas. And regardless of how many are dying, you know, it's always a party at night. There's always a party. There's candle vigils every single night also. And the energy's still there. There might be fatigue also. I think there might be in the coming weeks, especially with the internet blackout and also with schools kind of oppressing students, not allowing them to join the strikes. But back and forth, it's going to last. What the government is going to do, I see the option is either going to be a massive crackdown that is already starting. We're seeing just yesterday an activist from Maysan province was assassinated. Arrests are happening right now in Baghdad. And unless there's more international pressure on the government to stop at least just the violence and that kind of oppression, we're going to see a massive crackdown very, very soon.
Tammy, let me turn to you real quick. You know, you were in the United States government at the time of the first Arab Spring, and we see these developments, and inevitably they kind of raise these questions of people saying, is this Arab Spring 2.0? Is this a different sort of movement, a related movement? What sort of parallels and similarities do you see? What lessons should we be drawing, at least to be as informed observers? And how is this different? What is it? Is it drawing too much continuity between the two to draw that parallel?
Yeah, it's interesting also that, you know, these protests in Iraq and Lebanon are coincident with protests in Chile and other places. So it's, you know, it's not only a question of an Arab Spring. It's a question of what's triggering protest movements in a number of different countries around the world. What is it with this resurgence of mass mobilization? I think a lot of cynicism did emerge in the wake of the Arab uprisings in 2011, because those uprisings were so inspiring and so hopeful and did fundamentally transform some parts of the region, some for better and some ultimately for worse, you know, but they shook the foundations of these countries in a very fundamental way. And so I think inevitably, whenever you see thousands and thousands of people, especially young people in the streets, unafraid of the potential consequences, unafraid of potential violence from the state, demanding change, that's inspiring, right? So at that very, very basic human level, there are clear parallels. There are other parallels, though, that relate to sort of underlying structural features in the region that have been there for a long time, that produced the pressures that burst out in the Arab uprisings of 2010 and 2011, and that are bursting out again here because those underlying drivers have been unaddressed. And, you know, those issues relate to these clientelistic systems of governance, governments that are fundamentally about protecting and enriching elites and not fundamentally about delivering services to citizens, governments that don't treat people equally, but that allocate resources according to ascriptive identity, whether it's religion or sect or ideology or tribe. And it's also about, you know, a young generation of Arabs who are, as Rasha was noting, in Iraq, these are more educated Arabs, more educated Iraqis who are rising up. You know, they're aware of what they're missing out on. They're connected to the world around them. They see that other countries have managed to change things that they feel that they're stuck with, and they're simply not willing to tolerate the excuses of the past. I think in 2011, you know, Arab autocrats tried to claim, you know, well, if it's not me, it's chaos. And unfortunately, I think Muammar Gaddafi and Bashar al-Assad kind of created a self-fulfilling prophecy there. And so for some of these other governments, especially Iraq and Lebanon, because they're right next door to Syria, they could sort of point to Syria and say, well, you don't want to be like that. So whatever you're upset about, you know, don't push it too far, because that's dangerous and scary. And I think what we're seeing this year is Iraqis and Lebanese saying, no, I don't accept that excuse anymore. You can't scare me with potential danger of change. What we have is so unacceptable that I'm willing to take the risk. And, you know, as I think both Randa and Rasha were describing, there's a kind of a careful balance between those in the society who are willing to take the risk and those in the society who maybe aren't as willing to take as much risk on behalf of change. But there is a desire to push the boundary. I think the other thing that's happened that's significant is that, you know, there is at least one country in the region that in the wake of the 2011 uprisings made a full transition to democracy. And even though, you know, Tunisia is not necessarily a model for other states in the region, it is a counterexample to the claim made by those who protect the status quo, the claim that it can't be any different than this. This is the only way. And Tunisia is showing that, well, there is another way that's working so far. I mean, it's not, you know, Tunisia's economy isn't doing fantastically well, and there are concerns about corruption and so on. But they just had an election, and people were able to cut down to size all of the previously existing political movements and political elites and throw them out and bring in guys who are new. And so I think that, too, you know, just creates counter pressure against the claims of those who are trying to preserve the status quo. And it gives protesters a reason to believe that they might be able to produce a different future. But as I think we've heard from, you know, from the other folks on this podcast already, realizing it's possible to have a different future and building a road to get a different future are two different things. And protest movements are really, really good at creating opportunities, but they're not really good at producing outcomes. To produce outcomes, you have to have something that takes people's desires and puts them into a process and puts them into institutions that makes change that will stick. So you can get a government to resign, but in order to get a better government that's going to do what you want, you have to have some institution and some negotiation and some process. And that's where the leaderless nature of these protests becomes an obstacle instead of an advantage.
Let me jump off that point and bring it back to you, Randa, with a question, although I'm going to direct it towards you, Rosh, about Iraq as well. Is, you know, this is fundamentally a challenge to the status quo in a lot of regards, and particularly, I would say, kind of the products of the status quo, the lifestyle that it means for your day-to-day Lebanese and Iraqi citizen. But what does that mean in terms of political action? What are the more concrete changes that are being pushed for or maybe being offered that you all see arising out of this potentially? In the case of Lebanon particularly, Randa, I mean, obviously this is kind of in a lot of ways a fundamental challenge to, as you mentioned, the Taif Accord, like the fundamental confessional system of government that's really been in place in Lebanon and in some ways promoted a degree of stability in Lebanon, by some accounts at least, since 1989, since 1990. What does it mean to shake those sorts of pillars of modern Lebanon in a lot of different ways, and what's going to come out of it?
Yeah, I think on this, I want to point out that I think also there needs to be, maybe I'm being here the devil's advocate, but there needs to be a word of caution about throwing out the system, you know, especially the system of power sharing. I mean, these are countries in the both in the case of Lebanon and Iraq, where you have a number of societal components. I'm not going to say, you know, sectarian or, you know, or ethnic or whatever. You know, I don't like to use these categories. But I think there is a system which the system of government, the system of power sharing is definitely preferable, you know, than, for example, what we have in Syria or what we had in Libya or what we have now in Egypt. So, and the societies like Iraq and Lebanon, which have all these different components in it, I mean, this is something that needs to be preserved. Now, it was based and negotiated on the wrong basis. It was put on the basis of sectarian quotas by, in the case of Iraq, a negotiation between the American occupier at the time and Iraqi expat, who are now, you know, part of the elites. In the case of Lebanon, it was a, you know, the Taif agreement, but it was also part of the how the system in Lebanon, since the founding of the modern republic, was always based on dividing power, political power, among different sectarian groups. So, but still, the whole principle of it, of power sharing, of not having one man, like in the case of Saddam Hussein, basically ruling the country, of having one family, like in the case of Assad in Syria, ruling the country, is still better, is still worth preserving, you know, in absolute terms. Now, its components, i.e. on what basis is this power sharing system based, and who is involved? What are the, who is involved as part of the sharing of power is what people are rising against. So it's worth noting that power sharing as an underlying principle of governance in the in this part of the world, in the Levant, is worth preserving. So what needs to be changed, it's changing the rules of the game by which this power sharing happens and who is involved in the power sharing, the components. So create a political space for new entrants, for new faces, for new parties. And that's where election laws are important. That's where constitutional amendments are important, because that's where, Tamara said, that's where the organizing principle eventually of the institutions are going to be drawn and going to be negotiated.
Rasha, let me turn the same question to you in regards to Iraq. Now, Iraq doesn't have quite as rigid a kind of confessional system as Lebanon does, but it's nonetheless a significant factor in the constitution. And it has this constitution that has been criticized from all corners in a lot of ways, very clearly has, by design, big open spots that on issues it doesn't resolve that were mostly just too controversial to resolve. But at the same time, if nothing else, has produced contested elections multiple times since 2006. And so it's some would say that that's progress, or at least an element that may be worth keeping. What are the protesters pushing for in regards to concrete change? What is that going to mean for Iraq's constitutional system, political system?
Okay, so the status quo in Iraq was also, like Rinda was saying, built very much on power sharing between the different ethnic and sect groups. And as a alternative for the one man in power, you know, Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime, the issue now that's facing this status quo and those in leadership is that, as Rinda also was saying, you know, when the United States government and made this agreement with the diaspora Iraqis at the time, the opposition, who were based in different parts of the world, them being Shia majority, naturally because the country is a Shia majority, they played on something very specific, which is the victimhood. Now, Shia victimhood is not a myth. That's absolutely 100% accurate, and it predates even the Ba'athist rule of Iraq and even the creation of the Iraqi state in the region. They can no longer use that excuse, not with this generation. With the generation of the post-2003, they have very much reconciled with the Shia identity, with the national Iraqi identity. So they cannot use that anymore. It cannot be that it's no longer we need to preserve the sort of, you know, Shia being in power as the majority, because if we don't, there is going to be another Ba'athist rule. That does not sell anymore, not with this generation. The young Shiites protesting, now they are protesting with portraits of Imam Hussein and the Iraqi flag side by side. So this is the biggest challenge. I genuinely believe that the protests in 2011, for example, they were marked as being secular against the marja'iyya, against the religious rule, and that in itself is against like liberalism and against democracy, because if you want a true liberal state and true democracy, you have to embrace everyone. So no, we cannot impose a secular state in the country. And of course, we don't even need to talk about the Sunni protests and how they were violated eventually and taken advantage of by radical groups, and what happened in Mosul Anbar is testament to that. But how do you label anti-Ba'athist young Shia protesters? What do you call them? You can't accuse them of being ISIS sympathizers. You can't accuse them of being Saudi or Israeli, though that's happening, but no one believes that either. So how the state is going to respond to this is very crucial. And I think the only answer that they have at the moment, as we're seeing right now, is more violence and more oppression and even more severe crackdown. So what to change in the Constitution? The protesters don't really buy the whole quota system anymore. They don't believe that 60% of openings or posts or positions have to go to a certain sect, 20% to some other, or 20% to the Kurds, 20% to the Sunnis. They believe by merit. They want someone who is capable of delivering, basically, regardless of sect. And I genuinely do believe that this movement has achieved that, at least, where in general Iraqis now believe this. They don't care who belongs to what sect or what they follow, as long as they are definitely good at governing. And that's something that Iraq has not had since 2003. Back to the leadership point that relates to this, there is no one so far that the governments have not produced anyone or presented anyone with this capability, and it is a leaderless movement so far. So the alternatives, as Tamara was saying previously, it's not there. Brenda mentioned earlier that, you know, leaders sometimes and civil society activists are assassinated. In Iraq, it's even worse than Lebanon. So there's that aspect too. We've seen unfortunate statements from the United Nations that are very supportive of the government and not so much taking into account the massive tragedy that is ongoing in the country, where victims have now almost approached 300, all preventable deaths that did not have to happen because it was peaceful protesters and they were completely unarmed. So the government is kind of, you know, doesn't really have a reason to back down if it's still amassing support from the international body. So in this case, will the protesters actually take arms and face the state? I don't see that happening. They've very much been persistent on remaining peaceful. I do find that this movement will occur again in the next couple of years, more organized, possibly with the leadership also.
Yeah, I think this dynamic of, you know, how does the state respond in the face of this kind of protest is interesting. And Rasha, just listening to you describe the dynamic of how violence by the state actually generated a bigger response,
yeah.
You know, that the protesters come out in greater numbers and they demonstrate sort of more persistence, more determination. And that confrontation between protesters and the state in Iraq, the sort of fight to get across the bridges mm-hmm. toward the green zone and be pushed back across the bridges by the army. I mean, this is, it almost becomes a world unto itself, the bridge, right? The fight on the bridge and what part, how far do we get on the bridge? And all of that, of course, is related to, but separate from the argument for political change, like the concrete demands that people are trying to make of their government. But the violence almost enables a distraction or a change of topic from the core political demands. And I find it really striking that in Lebanon, you know, so far the Lebanese armed forces hasn't behaved perfectly, but it has behaved reasonably well, particularly in and around Beirut, in protecting protesters and not using force against protesters. Others have in Lebanon. And, you know, in both of these societies, there are armed militias in addition to the official security forces. And so we've seen attempts to break up the protests, particularly by Hezbollah and its allies in Lebanon, but they have not so far succeeded. And the LAF is kind of taking a different role. And I wonder, I mean, both of you might want to give thoughts on this, but how much does it matter whether the international community puts pressure on a government in a moment like that to not use force and to let people protest? Because if the Iraqi government is willing to send out snipers to shoot citizens in the street, that's because it feels existentially challenged. And does it really matter if the United States of America, which is not exactly like a paragon of virtue in the Iraqi moral universe, right? Does it matter if the United States government says, you know, you shouldn't shoot protesters? And in the Lebanon case, you know, where the U.S. government has said people have the right to peacefully protest and they should be allowed to protest. So it has made its views clear. But at the same time, now the White House is withholding aid to the Lebanese armed forces, which has been not shooting people. So.
Yeah, I just wanted to, if I can just clarify, the United States has also made actually quite a bold statement yesterday that towards the Iraqi government. I 100% believe that, yes, pressure will help and not statements. Pressure as you have a government in power, actual pressure, sanction a few people, say, you know what, you're not going to be welcomed in Europe anymore. Once those vacations and summer vacations stop for our officials, I think they might actually say, okay. Now we know who. Randa laughs. That's a sign of approval. They might actually be, you know, we saw when there was the ban on certain countries. Iraqi officials I had never heard from a long time started actually protesting because they were no longer going to be able to visit the States. So maybe do that. Maybe some pressure like this can absolutely help.
Shopping trips to London, you know, those are important.
There you go. Yes. It might be challenging in our case because most of our officials are dual nationals. So I don't know, figure out a way, maybe just sanction, start saying, you know what, if you don't stop these snipers, if you don't stop targeting these young protesters with tear gas canisters that are stuck to their skulls, we're going to actually start doing some things instead of having someone from the UN tour with the protesters and then come out and make a shameful statement like what happened. and was which was 100% supportive of the government. This is the kind of pressure I'm referring to, not just statements. And I think this is the least that they deserve. Now, we're not calling for international intervention. I want to clarify that. No one wants 150,000 troops again, trust me. There's a sign actually in the building, on the Turkish building, that says no to, literally, no to Iran, no to America, no to Saudi Arabia. This is a 100% grassroots Iraqi movement. We want the free people of the international community to stand up with us. That's what they're calling for, this kind of pressure. Definitely not not an intervention like Syria style. We don't want anyone to train a few groups that go rogue later on and we, you know, burn the whole country down. Just these kind of measures that should not be so drastic, you know, but I think they can achieve something.
You know, in terms of the Lebanese armed forces, it's interesting. I think there the international pressure, international assistance has helped in a major way. But also, I think also we have to remember how the Lebanese army sees itself and its role in the country. Traditionally, the Lebanese army has seen itself, especially when it comes to political contest. And they look at this as a political contest between the protesters and between, you know, the political elites, between, you know, a good part of the Lebanese street and, you know, another part of the Lebanese streets. They try to stay in the middle. They don't like to take sides, and partly because it's a political makeup and because always the decision, you know, of the Lebanese army are always subject to political approval. In this case, you had the president. We know that the president and Hezbollah have been putting pressure on the head of the army to use more force to open roads, you know, for example. And they have resisted that pressure. And I think partly because two reasons. One, this is the cynic in me. The head of the army, you know, like the current president and the two previous heads, the two previous presidents, had political aspirations. So, I mean, we have had two presidents already and this one who were heads, chiefs of the army. So this current chief, you know, also holds political aspiration after, you know, maybe in the future he can become again a president. I mean, like his predecessors, he can become a president. And I think him ordering the use of force against a large swath of the Lebanese is not going to bode well for his political prospect. That's a cynic in me. The second, I think, motivation is that the Lebanese army depends a lot on American assistance, you know, and has depended a lot on American assistance. But also the Lebanese army leadership, officers, rank and file, have also benefited over the last years of training, education, you know, provided by American military on how to deal with protest, on, you know, civil-military relations. And I think that has seeped into the institution itself and has really shaped how it looks at its rules of engagement in this case. But as Tamara said, we have not seen a consistent behavior by the army vis-a-vis the protesters. For example, in southern part of the country, especially in Hezbollah-controlled area, we have seen the army being more, not using more force, but standing on the sideline while thugs sent by Nabi Birri's Amal or by Hezbollah sent into the protest streets to disperse protesters, attack protesters. We saw the army standing on the sideline. Whereas in the case of downtown Beirut, we have seen the army basically interject itself between the thugs sent by the same groups into downtown Beirut. So the behavior of the army, all in all, has been professional, restrained, but it has not been consistent. But I think part and the international pressure, I think the army, you know, is keen on maintaining military assistance. I think what I'm hearing is this decision from the White House to withhold $100 million worth of military assistance to the army is now might be rescinded. And so because of pushback from, you know, congressional quarters, pushback from inside the administration. But definitely, as Tamara said, I mean, this was definitely an ill-timed decision, not thought through decision, self-defeating decision. And it sends exactly the wrong message to the Lebanese about the liability of the United States as a partner. It sends a wrong message. It reinforces the narrative of Hezbollah that the United States is not a reliable partner. It also creates, you know, open space for countries like Russia, which has been for a long time now trying to basically get into the game and trying to, you know, sell weapons to the Lebanese army, project more power inside Lebanese politics, and has been rebuffed, you know. And I think if the United States is not there at this time for Lebanon, you are going to see more opportunities for countries like Russia to inject themselves, undermining really decades long of United States-Lebanese cooperation.
And that kind of actually is a good pivot point to what my kind of closing question for all of you. We've talked a little bit about U.S. potential reactions, the international community. But, of course, there's one actor in the international community that's implicated by all these protests, particularly when you read them through the Western or American media lens. But I still think plays a very organic central role, and that is Iran. Iran, obviously, very instrumental in Lebanese politics because of their support of Hezbollah, and even more directly in Iraqi politics through its relationship and direct involvement in a variety of capacities. What should we take away from this about what these protests mean for Iran's posture towards the world and its engagement with countries like Lebanon and Iraq, and perhaps more broadly, its kind of broader general strategy? And can we or should we expect Iran to learn or take away anything away from this in a productive direction or the opposite? Russia, why don't I start with you?
So there's a quote going around on the internet. I don't know how accurate it is, but it is from someone who definitely does know a lot of things. And allegedly, Qasem Soleimani said at some point, I'm willing to die in Syria once, but willing to die in Iraq 20 times. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to kind of conclude from that kind of statement. Do I think Iran is going to change its trajectory? I'm not personally one to believe that there's a hardliner versus moderate Iran kind of, you know, distinction when it comes to foreign policy. Now, you know, internal policies in Iran, absolutely. But when it comes to foreign policy, I'm not one to believe they definitely have a distinction. I don't think Iran is going to give up Iraq easily. There's way too much investment. And as a neighbor, it's geographically impossible. There's, you know, entangled history and culture and religion, a lot of aspects of it. However, is this what is this for Qasem Soleimani when he sees his portraits being burned and, you know, in the streets in Shia majority capitals, and a general conviction of the entire Iraqi nation, all the people, at least the vast majority, that he is behind at least the direct killings of these protesters. Again, I go back to the point that the reason why there's such a massive movement now, it's basically because of the young men who died on October 1st to October 12th. And the entire country is implicating him. There's a report now, just now published by Amnesty, that the tear gas canisters and a lot of the bullets used are all Iranian manufactured. That's a further implication. So does he consider this a success? Is Iran going to change its policy? I think with pressure from the Marja'iyya, probably also from the Sadr, from Muqtada Sadr, who's been going back and forth to Iran constantly, I think there's something bigger in the picture there that we don't know yet. There might be sort of a pullback temporarily, at least, you know, in the future, but not before quelling the protests the same way that the Green Movement was quelled in Iran. And this is where we go back to the international community, at least stopping just the killings, not necessarily getting involved with what happens next, but pressure to just stop the slaughter that's going on. And it's very unfortunate for Iraqi protesters, and I think the same for a lot of the Syrian people, to sort of now, you know, being caught where we're in an era where, in general, the West rejects intervention of any kind. And any note that any whenever there's a protest movement, oh, is it aided by the West? What, let's say what America thinks. Oh, actually, no, let's say what Donald Trump thinks. Because if he's against it, I'm with it. Unfortunately, Iraq has kind of been caught through that. You know, the president tweeted something about burning the sacking of the Iranian consulate in the south of Iraq. The vast majority of Iraqis were not for that. All he had to do was retweet it to sort of say, hey, look, who's supporting this? So this is definitely an American movement, you know, towards the country that is against Iran and the whole resistance axis, where suddenly, you know, this is an imperialist protest. We should not support it. And it's very unfortunate that Iraqis, the ones protesting in Tahrir Square, are kind of caught into that. And there is, of course, a direction we see that tendency also in Washington to sort of wait where this administration stands on something so there can be an almost automatic stance against it. There's very little nuance when it comes to this. So we don't want war with Iran. The protesters don't want war with Iran. What we want is the IRGC, what they want, I don't want to speak on their behalf, is the domination, not even communication. You know, again, like I was saying, Iran is a neighbor. Thousands of Iraqis visit Iran every year. the relationship between the people is in fact a very, very strong one. It's just the IRGC domination and the exporting of the revolution needs to end. And I believe, genuinely believe, that this generation of Iraqis, those born after 1990, will not accept what the previous generations actually were okay with, what the opposition before 2003 was okay with. They're not going to accept this. And on the long term, this is going to have implications. Right now, with these protests, I don't see a lot of change, maybe just a slight pushback. But within the next 10, 15 years, definitely things will absolutely change.
Renda, how about you?
I think, you know, the behavior of Hezbollah shows one thing, is that they do not see this as an existential threat to them. I think definitely Iran and the popular mobilization forces in Iraq see what's happened in Iraq as an existential threat. And that's why I agree with Russia, Qasem Soleimani and the Quds Force are going to put all they have to stop this or to prevent it from gaining more strength. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has so far restrained itself pretty much, except as few times here and there sending thugs. But it has really did not deploy the force that Hezbollah has deployed in Syria, for example. And it's not going to, because it doesn't see in this protest as an existential threat. And the protesters have been very smart, you know, especially those who are not in Hezbollah's strongholds, not to raise the issue of Hezbollah's weapon, Hezbollah's paramilitary status. Although, as I said, ending the status quo is going to upend a political understanding that has been favorable to Hezbollah, which has been supported by all the political elites. But still, I think the fact that the Hezbollah's weapons are not at one of the principal demands has enabled, and rather its corruption and it is services, it is governance issues, has enabled Shia protesters in Hezbollah's strongholds to join this protest. And because if it is about Hezbollah's weapons, the consequences of them protesting, even though they embrace the demand, the consequences are going to be too harsh. And they understand the cost will be too harsh, because that's the red line for Hezbollah. It's the weapons. It is this, the armed non-state status. That's a red line for Hezbollah that they need to preserve. And so what you have is you have them, you know, willing to give space for protesters in their stronghold, Shia protesters, to rise up against corruption, partly because Nasrallah himself declared a year or so ago that Hezbollah is going to lead the fight against corruption. And so in a way, Nasrallah coming out and saying, "I'm here," there are two red lines for us going forward. One is no resignation of the president, and the second, no early election, meaning no new speaker of the parliament, Nabih Birri, at a time when both Aoun and Birri are seen as, you know, the among the top three, four corrupt officials by the protesters, including by Shia, has also affected this aura that Hezbollah has tried to envelop itself and its narrative. So on one hand, it has always claimed itself to be clean, non-corrupt, you know, not interested in politics as usual. And on the other hand, it has claimed its weapons are there for the defense of the people and are because there are no other capable institutions to defend those people. I think the split-screen image of Hezbollah ML thugs attacking protesters versus the Lebanese army standing there to protect protesters has not been lost on Lebanese and particularly on Hezbollah constituents. You know, I mean, if you are there to protect us, why are you sending people to basically kill us and attack us and harm us? So that has affected this. Now, in terms of Iran, look, Iran has not been a visibly dominant actor in Lebanese politics, as is the case in Iraq. You know, there Soleimani comes in and goes and issues order, has an office, has staff, you know. In Lebanon, Iran has traditionally left the whole field of maneuver and the whole domestic space to Hezbollah. Hezbollah is if there is an Iranian franchise, Hezbollah is the first franchisee in a way. And so that trust relationship between Iran and Hezbollah, that relationship based on their respect for Hezbollah's capabilities that has evolved over many years since 1982, when the relationship between the IRGC and Hezbollah, or what eventually became Hezbollah, started. So that has that makes Iran less visibly involved in Lebanon, and so you did not see those slogans that you are seeing in Iraq, partly because Iran is not as visible. And then also you don't have Iranians as visible in the street, whereas Iranians come in the millions, in Arba'in. And so Iraqis, and we don't have a border. Lebanon does not have a border with Iran. And so you don't have that kind of trade and visits and family links and all of this. So that's why I think whatever Iran has been doing with Hezbollah will continue. Because again, I don't see this protest movement representing an existential threat to Hezbollah as of now. Now, if it evolves, if it's able to organize itself, if it's able to, translate its political momentum into institutional presence, into institutional reforms, especially politically, I think then Hezbollah will have to, will be concerned, I think. Right now, I don't think they are concerned, and I don't see a reason as a result why they are going to change their political trajectory for now. Again, it all depends on how sustained, how smart, how mobilized this protest movement can continue.
Tammy, let me go to you for the last word.
Yeah, I think that Rhonda is exactly right to note that ultimately whether this opening created by the protests is an opening for greater Hezbollah influence or greater Iranian influence or for diminished Iranian influence, it's going to be up not only to Iran and Hezbollah, but it's going to be up to the protesters. How concrete can they be about their political demands? How unified can they remain behind those political demands? To what extent can they get any elite participation on behalf of those demands? In Iraq, perhaps there's more opportunity for that than in Lebanon. But, in Lebanon, there were people who came from civil society and ran for parliament on an anti-corruption platform a year ago. They got very little support, And part of the reason people are out in the streets is because they have such mistrust of institutional politics. So it's not just these elites and these parties and these leaders that they don't trust. They don't trust the whole system. And that means that anyone who comes forward and says, okay, but I'm going to run for parliament, also gets hit with mistrust. If the protesters are going to achieve gains out of this, they have to put that aside. They have to identify people that in whom they are willing to place their faith and know that they can hold them accountable, even if it means they have to go back out in the streets a year from now to hold them accountable. But if they don't take that leap of faith, if they don't put their weight behind some figures who can carry their agenda forward, then I worry that this will just be an opening for more influence by those who are expert at exploiting the divisions and the gaps within these societies, and that's primarily Iran. Now, what's clear to me also, and this is my parting shot, in all of this discussion about Iran and where it may end up in the wake of all of this, is that the United States has extremely limited capability to affect that dimension of the outcome. We can screw it up, but there's not a lot that we can do to ensure that Iran is marginalized from this. And what worries me, what I see from Secretary Pompeo's statement this morning, for example, is a little bit of like tap dancing on what he seems to perceive as the grave of Iranian influence in Iraq and Lebanon. I mean, I know he's not that naive. It would be delusional. But, you certainly don't want to do your end zone dance when you're still on the 40-yard line, if I can use a bad sports analogy. And we're a long, long way from actually seeing a challenge to Iranian influence that is meaningful in producing, in marginalizing Iranian influence or reducing Iranian influence in the politics of these countries. And, we certainly should not be crowing about any challenges they're facing. In Iraq in particular, we are at least as much of a target, even if we're not manipulating Iraqi politics
to the same degree. Yeah, I wouldn't say the same. Definitely there is like this they don't want a scenario, like I was saying, like in Syria, where there's a specific kind of support. I wouldn't say definitely not as bad. I would, however, not dismiss the protesters and what they're saying and what they are expressing towards Iranian domination because through a United States lens. It's really important that at the end of the day, their voices are heard. And if the international community, not just America, this is not America's burden, of course, alone, if the international community can support in at least just to stop the violence that's going on, so people, like you were saying, Tamara, which is very, very important, people that these protesters trust can actually come forward without being killed.
Yes.
If we can achieve that point, if the international community can help at least Iraq with that point, that's great. That's all they need.
A practical takeaway, Scott. What more do you want?
How we hope to end every episode of the Lawfare Podcast. Thank you all so much for coming to talk about this important and fascinating set of developments. We appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever else you may have found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patcha Howell, and our audio engineer for this episode is Jacob Schultz. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.